In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we get a different perspective on the origin of Thanksgiving Day by referencing early texts gathered from the library of returning guest Harry Hubbard. His video on YouTube titled In Search of Thanksgiving uncovers an anomaly in the historic record regarding the publishing of original manuscripts describing the events during the 1600s at the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Strangely, the original writings of William Bradford, John Winthrop, Edward Winslow, and others have been consistently published a century or so later from the handwritten manuscript. In addition, as pointed out by many scholars, the official record of history depicting the life of early settlers in the 1600s has been dramatically revised in later accounts. Harry Hubbard describes multiple cases of stolen or missing original manuscripts that suddenly turn up hundreds of years later. We explore some ideas of what may have happened to recorded history in the 18th century. Today, Thanksgiving is described as being celebrated on the fourth Thursday in November by U.S. federal legislation in 1941. There are a list of other countries that recognize their own Thanksgiving, including the Netherlands, Canada, St. Lucia, Grenada, Australia, and the U.K. Our guest, Harry Hubbard, is a researcher and collector of rare books, maps, and artifacts. We spoke with him in previous interviews about the ancient Egyptian repository in the southern Illinois caves, and also on the many maps depicting Atlantis and the Bargos Islands at the North Pole. We look today at how the word Thanksgiving is referenced in various historic texts, in the strange conflicting accounts in revised editions of original manuscripts that were released much later. Harry, welcome back to Another News.
Thank you.
You made a video on some of the references in various early texts on Thanksgiving in the United States. Can you give listeners a quick list of books that you've gone through?
Well, I wanted to go back into the 1800s because you hear so much conflicting stories, so many conflicting stories, and people wanting to write about this and say that the pilgrims did this and did that and the Indians did this and did that. And I'm like, you know, that's not what I remember from reading about it years ago, whatever. So I went back to my encyclopedia set from 1879, the American Encyclopedia, and then I come up through pre-World War II Britannica. I used the 1899 Century Book of Names, Century Encyclopedia of Names. I used William C. Bryant's History Book, Volume 1. I used Edward Ellis' History of Our Country, which was 1895. Used Volume 1 of that. I also used Ridpath from the late 1800s. And going back is how you figure out what is true and what is not true. That's what I did. I try to just prove to the listener, my audience, by showing them in the book what I'm talking about. And I just felt that it was necessary. I was talking to Paul about a month ago, and I was watching on TV, and what I saw on TV on PBS was absolutely not anything near what I'd remember. So I went back and did a little quick study on it and put this show together for everybody for a Thanksgiving present.
Was there anything specific in the PBS presentation that stuck out?
Yes, they got several things wrong and concerning the Native Americans. And I just like, you know, I'm reading a book from the 1800s. It's not like that at all. And I don't want to go into it because it's politically incorrect and it could frustrate some people with your audience. I don't want to do that.
So. No problem. So this prompted you to put this video together, and let's go through some of the beginning here. Now, you start off with the American Encyclopedia, a popular dictionary, general knowledge, with the definition of Thanksgiving Day. It reads, an annual religious festival observed in the United States and particularly New England, suggested by the Hebrew Feast of Tabernacles or Feast of Ingathering at the end of the year. The occasional observance of a day of Thanksgiving formerly recommended by the civil authorities was not unusual in Europe, and such a day was observed in Leiden, Holland, October 3, 1575, the first anniversary of the deliverance of that city from siege. What is the significance of the multiple Thanksgiving days, not only in the United States, but in other countries?
Well, other countries that I can see, they don't have one, then another, then another, then another. It was pretty much cut and dry. Here in the United States, it appears that they had so many days in the same year that were Thanksgiving, and on and on and on, and then they finally decided to be that it would be in November. That was pretty much what it tried to cut. And there were a lot of people that didn't know about what it said concerning the Feast of the Tabernacle, et cetera, et cetera. You know, with that was an eye-opener for many people, the feedback that I'm getting from the video, which is warmly received. I'm not trying to sway. I'm just showing what I found, and I've left the door open for many future research, many future researchers to take on their own path with this presentation.
You definitely did that. In this first account in the American Encyclopedia, it references Governor Bradford. It reads, after the first harvest of the colonists at Plymouth in 1621, Governor Bradford sent four men out fowling that they might, after a more special manner, rejoice together. But this is really interesting. So,
yes, I thought so too, considering that maybe the years got crisscrossed somewhere in the folklore. I mean, these manuscripts were missing for, you know, decades, centuries, you know, and who knows what the originals had in them.
It says, it reads, in July 1623, a day of fasting and prayer, and the governor appointed a day of Thanksgiving, which was observed with religious services. So that 1623, another account was 1631, and as you pointed out, in June of 1632, Governor Winthrop of Massachusetts Bay Colony recommended a day of Thanksgiving on account of action of British Privy Council favorable to the colonies and invited the governor of Plymouth Colony to unite with them. There's a record of the official appointment of days of Thanksgiving in Massachusetts Bay in 1633, 1634, 1637, 1638, and 1639. So it wasn't every year, but it started to become more consistent.
Correct. And what I thought it was, the reason I pointed out about the fowling is because we have another reference that indicates the same story, but in a different year. That's why I wanted to point out about the four men that went out fowling, and when the Indians brought in game of the chase or animals of the chase. Well, what year was that? You know, if we're, one guy's saying it's one year, another guy's saying it's another year, so flip a coin.
Occasional Thanksgiving days, this is the same reference, the American Encyclopedia, by the way, Popular Dictionary General Knowledge, the year of this book that you cite is 1879, and it reads, occasional Thanksgiving days were appointed by the Dutch governors of New Netherland in 1644, 1645, 1655, and 1664, and by English governors of New York in 1755 and 1760. In 1858, Thanksgiving proclamations were issued by governors of the eight southern states.
Now, bear in mind, at this time, none of these records were available. Okay? So when you're dealing with these manuscripts, you have to realize that in the late 1600s, none of these manuscripts existed that they're basing a lot of this on. So what we're doing is we're creating things out of thin air, or so it would appear.
Mm-hmm.
And then going back and filling in the gaps.
Now, the next book you reference, Volume 3, page 180, is that the Encyclopedia still, the American Encyclopedia?
Yes.
Okay, this is still in the American Encyclopedia.
Yes.
William Bradford, governor, at an early age emigrated to Holland for the sake of religious liberty, and having joined the congregation at Leiden, sailed for America in 1620 in the Mayflower. Why?
Correct.
Why did you cite William Bradford here? What is significant about him and his experience and life?
Because they give him credit for recording the first Thanksgiving. And after the Mayflower got here, many people stayed on the ship for that winter, and many people went to land. And the people who went on land while the ship was just anchored out in the harbor, the people who went to land, all of them died. Like half of, like 54 people just died of exposure and disease, melee. And Bradford, when he got into, when he embarked and got to the shore, whatever, Carver, who was the first governor, died almost immediately. Him and his wife and his son, they all died. And Bradford got elected to the position. And so he was actually the first running governor of the Plymouth Colony.
And reads, one of his first acts was to adopt measures to confirm the league with Massasoit, who afterward disclosed to the colony a dangerous conspiracy among the Indians, which was suppressed.
And there are several different year references for that, when it actually happened, or the old books are still ambiguous concerning that. It's not printed exactly the same each and every time.
Though without a learned education, he wrote a history of Plymouth Colony from 1602 to 1647. 1602 is weird because if he didn't get there until 1620, that might be a mistake.
That same mistake is in several different books, but realize also that those manuscripts still weren't popular. So the guy writing 1620 in the 1800s, he hadn't seen those journals yet.
Oh.
They're in 1602. See, because it's, if you go back, all of them are saying 1602.
Oh, they are.
Well, is it that they really didn't understand that he wasn't there, or did he actually record? We don't know. It's certainly not in his Plymouth Plantation.
Okay, on the retreat of the British Army in 1775, the manuscript was carried away from the library of Old South Church in Boston, but was recovered and printed entire by the Massachusetts Historical Society in 1856. And as you point out, you emphasize 200 years later, about?
Yeah, and there's still conflicting evidence. Some say that they just discovered that it was missing in 1774. Others say it was missing then, or we don't know when the manuscript was stolen. It could have been gone any time between 1728 and 1774. It could have been swiped any time in that area, in that time frame.
So whatever happened, whatever really happened, or that was recorded by William Bradford in that manuscript, was very, very important to certain people.
Mm-hmm. Most likely.
I wonder why.
And I why? Well, people can get these and step on them and sanitize them. The presentation kind of points this out as it goes along. And just showing the references and explaining to them, I don't interject my opinion that much, that often, but I'm pretty much sticking to the script of just showing you the information and letting you make up your own mind.
Wonder why it took so long also to reprint this or put this out. It took two centuries?
You got me there, buddy. You got me there. Even still, how did they go back and forth across the ocean and still, I mean, it's 2 months, a leather parchment, or what did they write this on? Is anyone's guess of how's the paper going to, or the leather or the skin, how's it going to last for 2 months? We're talking now 4 months on the ocean, 2 months there, 2 months back. Did somebody go there and recopy it hand for hand?
Mm-hmm.
It's anybody's guess, man. There's still so much mystery in all this that I do not have all the answers, and I believe that I point that out. I do not have all the answers, and there's a lot of things, a lot of questions that come to mind. Once I made the presentation, as I was editing it, I actually even noticed things myself that I could have gone more into descriptions through the old history books and the old encyclopedia sets. But the video is an hour and 15 minutes long as it is, and how much more do you want? You know, I mean, I could do it and keep going and keep going.
It's true.
But I just chose to make it. I kind of want to keep things under an hour and 20 minutes.
The book that we're referencing is by William Bradford, this particular one, titled Of Plymouth Plantation. It was republished in 1952. This is what you point out. Bradford's history descended through his heirs until it came into the hands of Reverend Thomas Prince, a Boston antiquarian and bibliophile, in 1728. On his death, the manuscript became part of the Library of the Old South Church in Boston. After the War of Independence, the manuscript was discovered to be missing from the collection. It was not until 1855 that reference to the book in a history of the Protestant Episcopal Church in America gave scholars a clue to its whereabouts.
Who were those scholars? Who were the scholars? Who were the scholars that noticed that? Who were the scholars? Oh, maybe they've got this manuscript. Well, let's put somebody on a ship 2.5 months later. He gets off the ship and starts looking for it. And then, which library was it actually found in? We got reference for two different libraries.
Since this manuscript has great interest to a number of people and has moved around so much, it may very well still exist somewhere.
Well, possibly. But my goodness, even between Bradford's death in 1657 and up to 1728, well, that's a bunch of winters that it had to get frozen and a bunch of summers, hot, sticky summers. Well, books today, they're not going to last in, you know, in somebody's old log cabin for 70 years. It's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So the thing must have been in tatters. And then it sails across the ocean again after gosh knows how many decades of summer and winter. We don't know. The whole thing is a big question mark.
Mm-hmm. It was printed in its entirety in 1856 and returned to this country in 1897 with great fanfare. It is on view in the library of the State House in Boston.
So that's a good line, because that tells us that it was never brought here to be republished in 1855. Somebody had to go over there and recopy. Well, who recopied it? Who sanitized it? And then they had to bring back, okay, so now you got a guy that's going 2 months in a ship back to England. He searches, he finds it in these library, whichever library anybody wants to call it. Mm-hmm. And then he sits down and starts penning the whole thing. I don't think so, man. And something's not right. I'm just saying, something's not right with the scenario.
So that's Bradford. That's William Bradford's work. And it's filled with unusual discrepancies, but consistent with what you've pointed out with other people who have written personal accounts of their experiences and events at the Massachusetts Bay Colony in those early years in the 1600s. Edward Winslow, well, you do speak about John Winthrop. Could you tell listeners about him?
Well, he was the first governor. He was elected governor of Boston, basically, in England, before he embarked in the ship. And he was also a Puritan. Some say Episcopalian, some say Puritan. But the Puritans came out of the Episcopalian church. Okay? So that's, you could be one and the other at the same time and still have your faith.
Mm-hmm.
And he came here in, 1631, and set up shop and was governor of Boston.
Why do you reference him here?
Because I'm searching for Thanksgiving. He's going to have something to throw in there, isn't he? He's one of the first colonists. At some point, he's going to have to be referenced as far as Thanksgiving goes. You're not going to be able to do research on Thanksgiving and leave him out. You just can't do it. It would be improper.
Harry, the next person is William Hubbard, maybe a distant relative of yours.
Perhaps somebody has sent me a link to his genealogy, and I haven't examined it. So maybe. I don't know. It would be ironic that one of his descendants is talking about him, 400 years, almost 400 years later?
He was
350 years down the road.
He was born in England, 1621, and he died in Massachusetts in 1704, an American historian and clergyman. He wrote a history of New England, published 1815, in a book, Narrative of the Troubles with the Indians in New England, 1677. But here you have the century later it's published.
Yeah, he's another one. So now if anyone is trying to follow this, we're coming up through time, and all these guys are published over 100 years after they die. All of these manuscripts that we refer to back and forth concerning Thanksgiving or even the history of the colonies, it's all awash. We don't know that because the manuscripts are actually published for the first time long after they've been dead.
Which suggests that not only their family, but also friends and colleagues in that time have passed away. So revisions and rewriting history can be easily done. We're not saying it was.
Correct.
We're not saying it was done. As we go along, we'll see some discrepancies.
It's not just one writer or one chronicler. It's every doggone one of them. It's every single one of them.
The next book, 1929 Encyclopedia Britannica, Volume 22, page 170, Thanksgiving Day. And you point this out, the day is observed with religious services in the churches, and especially in New England, as an occasion for a family reunion. The pilgrims set apart a day for Thanksgiving at Plymouth immediately after their first harvest in 1621. The Massachusetts Bay Colony for the first time in 1630, and frequently thereafter until about 1680, when it became an annual festival in that colony in Connecticut as early as 1639 and annually after 1647.
I can say that you have done your homework on this video. I am pleased that you know so much about it, and to think that I could put something together where a person such as yourself can put this many of the pieces together and know who these people are and realize what these references are all about. And I feel very honored in that respect, Jeff. I do. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Because I think this is great scholarly work and very important to review. And as you pointed out, it's a launching point for other scholars and researchers to add into this. And hopefully contact you.
I think that somebody, or really anybody, that has access to good library material, be it from the 1800s, informations from before World War II, and different things like that, could make some more discoveries, or even do some research in England or Holland, or whatever, just to add to the story. I don't think that I can be called wrong on anything, because I'm just showing you what the book says. And a lot of times, the books are in conflict with each other.
Okay, Harry, the next one here is Edward Winslow's letter of December 11th, 1621, describing our first Thanksgiving, quote, "our harvest being gotten, and our governor sent four men on fowling so that we might, after a more special manner, rejoice together after we..." Wait, I think I read this. Oh, yeah,
It starts getting... No, it starts getting confusing.
Quote, "our harvest being gotten, and our governor sent four men on fowling so that we might, after a more special manner, rejoice together after we had gathered the fruit of our labors. They, four in one day, killed as much fowl as with a little help beside served the company almost a week, at which time, amongst other recreations, we exercised our arms. Many of the Indians coming amongst us, and amongst the rest their greatest king, Massasoit, with some 90 men, whom for 3 days we entertained and feasted, and they went out and killed 5 deer, which they brought to the plantation and bestowed on our governor, upon the captains and others. The actual date of this festival is nowhere related." All right, this is because it's the same thing we just kind of read before. Let me see.
Yeah, and where was his manuscript? And don't forget, he's also Morbus Libro Contessimo Postmortem. His stuff was printed over 200 years after he died, too. I mean, every single one of them. So, who's right, who's wrong? I'm also glad that you're interviewing me on something that on a video that's real fresh in my mind and still something I did 20 years ago. Thank you. You got me a little bit of break there.
Oh, yeah, sure. It's a little bit easier, right? The next one is Encyclopedia Britannica, and you talk about John Winthrop again, born 1588, died 1649. 140 years after he died, part of his manuscript, History of New England, was published and edited and re-edited up to 1895.
That's what the book says. Yep, that's what it says. I'm not making it up.
So we have another case of, what did you call it?
Morbus libro contessimo postmortem. I had to have this expression. And what that means, translated from Latin into English, is over 100 years after you're dead, your book finally gets published. And in some of these cases, it was 200 years.
And yeah, here's another reference. I think this is in the Encyclopedia Britannica as well. What's the date on that encyclopedia, Harry?
1929.
Edward Winslow, 1595, he's born, passed away 1655, a founder of Plymouth Colony, born in England, took over governor for Bradford, was Bradford's assistant. And his writings, it reads, his writings, though fragmentary, are great value to the historian of the Plymouth Colony. Some of them may be found reprinted in Alexander Young's Chronicles of the Pilgrims in 1841.
Yeah.
Again.
200 years later.
And
200 years later. And that's what it's saying.
Okay, so the elephant in the room, if you will, is nothing from the 1700s.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Nothing but a bunch of missing documents. Correct.
And it's really odd that their work isn't printed until hundreds of years later. And that's a very consistent theme. May not be that unusual for historians to see consistent blackouts in recorded history.
You got me, brother. But it is, it's not all of the writers of this time. It just seems like it's the writers from the colonies. It just seems like it's the writers of the of this time frame that their stuff is just missing 100, 200 years. Boom. No consistency or consistently inconsistent. Does that make sense?
It does, and it's a red flag for anyone doing research of the Massachusetts Bay Colony back in the 1600s and wondering what was recorded and what had happened.
Well, now all somebody's going to do is go to Wikipedia or Google and read just, you know, online stuff, which in another 20 years, that's all you're going to have. That's all you're going to have. And people won't ever know or be able to appreciate the truth or the actual circumstances of what happened.
Now, you also mentioned no books were printed until after the Revolutionary War in the United States.
Correct.
They had to be printed in London?
Yes. Everything had to be certified and licensed. It was not allowed. Bulletins, signs, pamphlets, and little booklets, perhaps, or brochures, and that was pretty much it. And then later on, newspapers.
I gotcha. Very interesting. The next book that you reference by Reverend William Hubbard, The History of the Indian Wars in New England from the First Settlement to the Termination of the War with King Philip in 1677.
And this is a whole new set of Indian Wars. A whole new set. This is all way... Let's see, this is... it's like 40 years down the road after the Pequot Wars and the Connecticut Indian Wars.
Well, this book was, I guess, published in 1865, again, hundreds of years later, about 200 almost.
Close, yeah.
Then there was a reprint in 1969. The other book you reference here, Narrative of the Troubles with the Indians in New England, that came out, that manuscript was 1677. And
yes.
And it reads, the governor and council of the Massachusetts taking into serious consideration the many merciful occurrences that have been returned upon us, notwithstanding the mixing of many dispensations of a contrary nature, accounted themselves bound to make some public acknowledgement thereof to him whose name alone is worthy to be praised. The 29th of that month of June was set apart as a day of public thanksgiving.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
multiple Thanksgiving days.
Yes.
Another one that you reference is August 12th, 1670.
Yes, that's correct.
1676, a remarkable testimony of divine favor to the colony of Plymouth, who had for their former successes appointed the 17th day of August, following to kept as a day of solemn thanksgiving to Almighty God. Right? And you reference again the history of the Indian Wars in New England, first settlement to the termination of the War King with King Philip in 1677 from the original work of Reverend William Hubbard, Volume 2, a supplement concerning the war with the Pequods, 1865. Who was King Philip back then?
He was an Indian chief.
Okay.
He was an Indian chief. And I don't want to, it's not a good story. This is Thanksgiving. I want to keep it on Thanksgiving.
It's not a good story. It doesn't sound like a good story either.
No.
What you mentioned.
Not a whole lot of those stories back then ended.
They don't end very well for the Native Americans.
Yeah, correct.
Another book, here's the other book, A Popular History of the United States from the First Discovery of the Western Hemisphere by the Northmen to the End of the First Century of the Union of the States, preceded by a sketch of the prehistoric period and age of the mound builders by William Cullen Bryant and Sidney Howard Gay.
Great writer.
Harry, what's significant about this book?
Significant is it was printed in 1878. And the accounts that it gives were, that it presents, are what was available to him as a learned scholar in the late 1800s.
And he's talking about things that had taken place in the mid-1600s.
Yes. Now, what his references were, we don't know. But it's just interesting to me how there's so many different little conflicting things, little facts that don't stack up to the same issue.
This is that book with the page of the illustration is at night, seems to be a full moon. Last wars with Connecticut Indians. 8 only of the savages escaped. The Dutch with 15 wounded made their way back to Stamford. And a few days afterward, a Thanksgiving was celebrated on their arrival in Manhattan, which humbled the eastern tribes. They slaughtered the Connecticut Indians at night.
Yes. And afterwards, there was a Thanksgiving. That's why I had to point that out, because I'm searching for Thanksgiving. And those 8 Pequods, what they did was, that the ones that survived, the warriors that survived, they went over to the Mohegans. Well, the Mohegans were allied with the Puritans, okay, and with the governor there. And so now the Narragans, their actual name is called the Narragansetts, but the Narragans wanted the heads of those from the Mohegans. So now there's turmoil again over prisoners. It's just one party after another, man. I mean, just some of the stuff is just so outrageous. And like I said, we don't know all the facts. We really don't. We really don't know all the facts.
I'm not sure if this is in the same book. It reads, here, the other passage here, in February 1631 was a notable arrival. Sickness and want were at a time universal. Even the governor's tours were almost exhausted. Others of smaller means were on the scantiest allowance, and a day of fasting and prayer, the fasting and easy duty, was proclaimed. But before the day arrived, the shop line commanded by the good Captain William Pierce, who so often appeared precisely the right moment both at Plymouth and Boston, was reported at Nantasket. She was deeply laden with provisions, and the day of humiliation and supplication was changed to one of thanksgiving and praise. Talk about that for a minute, please.
Well, I'm searching for Thanksgiving. And whenever the word Thanksgiving pops up in these old books, in the 1600s, is what I'm documenting. I'm documenting the word Thanksgiving, not so much as the day, the celebration itself, but the occurrence of the word itself in all of these old books.
So here it pops up when the ship arrives.
Yes.
And it pops up with the slaughtering of Native Americans.
Correct.
Okay. Edward Ellis, you referenced 1900, the history of our country to the present time, 1895 to 1900. And it reads, the government was invested in a governor, deputy, and 18 assistants or magistrates elected annually by the stockholders of the company that you said London is what they refer to by the company?
Yes, yes, had to be.
The freemen were to meet in general assembly no fewer than four times a year in order to legislate for the colony. It should be remembered that the Massachusetts Bay Colony was founded by Puritans, while that at Plymouth was composed of independents.
Ain't that ironic?
Now, help listeners with this, because you mentioned the Pilgrims were Puritans and the Puritans were Pilgrims at Boston and Plymouth. Pilgrims
yes.
came out
they
of
they were
the...
all the same. In other words, where's this guy? Evidently, his Ellis, even though he's writing just at the turn of the last century, evidently his information was flawed. So I mean, or it was tainted one way or the other. You can play with it however you want to. It was either cleaned up, sanitized, flawed, or he just didn't know. Which I am under the suspicion that it was just put in that way for a reason.
Why is that?
Probably to cover up what actually happened, Jeff. I mean, it's opinionated and it's speculation. Whatever I say is just speculative. I don't know. I don't know the real reason. I don't have the reason. I was hoping you could tell me.
Pilgrims, you write, Pilgrims came out of the Protestant movement of the Episcopalian Church. Episcopal is the same as Catholic, same service structure, basically. Instead of a pope at the head, it's King James. Let's go right into Ridpath's History of the United States by John Clark Ridpath.
Yeah, and I don't want to turn your audience off with how I introduced the book. So if we just leave that and you can comment on it, but I don't want to touch on it too much because when you start to hear so much about the later accounts, it like what? You're kidding me. But it's all right there. I show it to you in the book. I show it to you in the book, and there's no denying it. There's no denying, and I think a lot of people would pick up on it real quick, and others might have more of a difficult time with it.
Okay, the title again is Ridpath's History of the United States. If you would, Harry, describe these books.
Well, Ridpath was writing in the last decade of the 1800s, and I used to have several of his sets of books, but then when I left Florida, I had to unload probably a half a ton or a ton of books because the books are heavy hobby, and it's a voluminous hobby. It just takes up a lot of time, a lot of room. And the thing is, I sold these books because they're really nice bound, nice leather gilded, stamped, gold gleaming, just beautiful books that I hated to give up for reasons of, you know, I would have never thought that I would have ever been doing a presentation on searching for Thanksgiving. And so even if I don't have a certain reference that I want or that I feel like I should have, what I've learned is I have enough already, and if I do have those references, it just makes the presentation longer and doesn't just drives in my point more and more and more each time. So if I can't find a book, or I know it's missing, or it's in a tote buried that I can't get to, for instance, the Samuel Eliot Morris book. I have that here somewhere, but I can't just go and look and dig it up and then make comparisons, because that's another whole video. And it just gets to where it's too time-consuming to use everything. So this one Ridpath book, it's a nice-looking book, and I just use the one because it covers pretty much what many of his other sets say. I mean, it's right there. It's in plain print where you can read it.
These books started with the Mound Builders of the Norsemen,
mm-hmm.
as you point out, and it was printed in 1897. Did you want to go into the Star and David and all that?
No,
I just
point out that a lot of these later writers have a lot of symbology and signs in their work. And if you're looking for these, you can sometimes get more of an idea of where the guy's coming from by the symbology he uses. Does that make sense?
Well, you're saying they're probably Freemasons here.
Oh, yes. Most definitely.
But Freemasons that very likely have an agenda here with rewriting history. Their facts in this don't necessarily match the original manuscripts.
That's what it would seem to indicate. Correct.
Yes. Well, in Chapter 7, it reads, "Passing to New England, we note with interest the progress of the first Puritan settlement planted by the pilgrims at Plymouth. At the beginning, there was a struggle most sharp for existence. The first winter, 1621, had well-nigh proved fatal to the whole company who debarked from the Mayflower. Hope, however, revived with the spring, and the first birdsong brought welcome to the weary heart of man. Though one half of the colony had been swept off by disease and exposure, the remainder went forward with courageous spirits to the work of destiny."
And isn't that, like, reversed from what we've been reading or what we've been discussing? So, hey, flip a coin.
Well, the first winter you mentioned, it was mentioned that some of them stayed on the boat because it was really cold, and then some people did die from exposure. However, it was also pointed out that there was abundance and lots to eat and this and that. So this is painting a different picture here.
Yes, a lot of people died. A lot of people were sick. It was a very bad harvest. And then we have chroniclers that say everything was happy, happy, joy, joy, abundance of everything, and no sickness. Yeah, exactly. You can flip a coin on it.
And you mentioned he jumps over everyone who is important. What do you mean by that?
He doesn't write anything in the passage there about Winthrop or Bradford. He just kind of goes into Captain Miles Standish, which I'm not going to go there because it was pretty hard on the Native Americans. So I don't want to go there. We're keeping Thanksgiving. We're keeping the giving, the G in Thanksgiving.
It reads, "In 1630, about 300 of the best Puritan families in England came to America under the direction of John Winthrop, who was chosen governor. Though royalist by birth, he cast in his lot with the Republican Party. Himself an Episcopalian, he chose to suffer affliction with the Puritans." Okay, this is the year 1630. Now, you pointed something out here that's significant.
Oh, yeah. Where is this crap coming from, you know? The Republican Party and the Democratic Party, you know? It was the Democratic Convention in Boston, the year 1630? I don't think so.
Meaning there wasn't a Republican Party in 1630?
No. Yeah, well, that's what he's saying, but evidently he didn't have access to pretty good books. I don't know. And there again, what are you going to believe? I just don't get it, man. I just don't get it.
And I think Wikipedia mentions anti-slavery activists, modernizers, and ex-Whigs and ex-free soilers in 1854. The Republicans dominated politics nationally. So,
as far as I know, the Republican Party came into existence about, it was either 1852 or 1854, somewhere along in there. Yeah. And I thought everybody knew that. Might throw somebody a curve if they read about the Republican Party in 1630. You know, I don't know anybody else that could tie all these twisted threads together into a presentation. I don't know. But now that I've done it, I think others can play on that and either pick it to death or go do more and better research. Maybe somebody somewhere in Boston, New Haven, Connecticut, or Cambridge, the old records at Harvard. Who knows what they could come up with if they just start digging into these passages and some of these writers, even going into earlier into the 1800s.
Oh yeah. So there's a blackout with recording history, as we mentioned, within the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what's going on there. And you mentioned there was a Freemason connection in terms of taking over the narrative. That's very possible. It deserves more research specifically in that area. And maybe some people will contact you and dig some more material up to add into this. It's very thought-provoking, and I hope will stimulate others to follow up on this, as you pointed out. And your work can be found on YouTube. Your name, Harry Hubbard, is what you type in to find Harry's work. I want to thank you again for being on In Other News.
Thank you, and we'll always be searching for Thanksgiving, won't we?
Indeed.
Thank you, Jeff.
We hear part of a speech now by Ray Fadden, a teacher and influential figure among the Mohawks of Akwesasne. He passed away in November 2008 at the age of 98. In 1930, Ray Fadden became one of the first teachers at the St. Regis Mohawk School in Hogansburg. Ray grew up in the Adirondack Mountains. He was part Mohawk and spent many years learning all he could about the Mohawk culture and history, both from books and from elders he met throughout the Iroquois Confederacy. Let's have a listen.
Now, when I was a little boy going to school, a long, long time ago, I hate to think of how many years ago, at that time, they taught very little about Indians in school. But sadly, at that time, always bad. Always. Well, I remember it. I remember that fat, ugly old teacher. Her name was Miss Gillespie. I don't remember learning any reading or writing arithmetic from her, but I do remember three statements she had to say about Indians, and she's serious. The only good Indian is a dead Indian. Indians are inferior to white people, both physically and mentally. Indians are like little children. They never think of the future. They just live from day to day without one thought of what's going to happen tomorrow. And I take a look at what the white man has done to this once beautiful land in the short time he's been here, and he can tell that the children in school think about it. I became a teacher too, a science teacher. It takes from 300 to 10,000 years, that long, depending upon the location, for one little inch of topsoil to form. Some parts of the Midwest, a short time the white man has been there, a little over 100 some years, that little while. 18 inches are washed down into the Gulf of Mexico. And they wonder why they have floods every year in the Mississippi, Missouri, Platte River Valley. Why the idiots strip the earth of all its protection. And they needn't blame it on that big population. The minute they landed on Plymouth Rock, they skinned our Mother Earth like you skin a muskrat, without one thought of the future. Anyone with any intelligence knows you don't cut trees down the side of a hill or a mountain like they did next door to me. But for that precious dollar bill they worship so much, they stripped those beautiful forests in California along the coast, and what happened right afterwards? The mud floods started covering their fancy houses. Did they learn anything? No, money first always. Right through California, Oregon, Washington, probably now Alaska. Where the cones used to hang from the trees? Used to be thousands of cones hanging from those trees. What happened to them? Why are our trees sick and dying? Acid rain. So what do the big brains do in the government? They have a study, and another study, and another study. And meanwhile, our Mother Earth is sick and dying. I'm living here where I can see what's happening. They continue to have these studies, and meanwhile, our Earth is sick. Do you realize the millions of animals and birds that depend on those cones and seeds to feed their little ones to survive? Oh, yes, they say acid rain kills fish. They say no more. Certainly it kills fish. And when the fish go, the mink, the otter, the loon, the blue heron, the fishhawk, the kingfisher, they go too. They had super salesmen coming around to all these little communities. Loon Lake, Vermontville, Merrillsville, Bloomingdale, Paul Smith, selling some kind of a chemical poison that's supposed to kill black flies. Out of curiosity, I went over the other side of that mountain to a little place called Vermontville to see what this fellow had to say. Little fat, stubby guy with a fancy suit, driving a big Cadillac car, big talker. Goes on and on about this wonderful product his company turns out that kills black flies. Funny, after a while he says, any questions? I says, yes, I have a question. What is it? Does it kill other insects? Oh, how he hates to answer that question. Talks all around my question. Finally, after 10 minutes, I said, mister, I hate to interrupt you, but you haven't answered my question. Does it kill other insects? Yes, next question before I could say a word. Dave Fayak, who used to live up here at On Chiota, raised bees, wanted to know if it killed bees. The same runaround. Finally, after a while, I said, look, he'd like to know, so would I. Does it kill bees? Yes, next question. I says, wait a minute. What are you fools trying to play God for? Every time you try to play God, you hurt this earth a little bit more. You take the future of our children away from them. If this kill, if no other reason, the black fly is very valuable. Do you know why? To keep you butchers out of the woods here. It won't kill every bird and animal there is. And if this kills a useful bug like a bee, how are we going to have any more pollination? How are we going to have any more apples, strawberries, cherry, chokecherries, raspberries, huckleberries, blueberries, and a thousand other plants? And if this kills all insects, what are the birds supposed to eat? What are the fish supposed to eat? What are the frogs, the toads, the salamanders, the darning needles, and a million other creatures supposed to eat? And when they die, what are the things supposed to eat to live on them and right on up the line? I wasted my breath. Big fat lady got up. She says, we don't care about the birds and the fish. We don't want our kids to be bitten with black flies. I says, you continue to do these things and you will destroy the future of your own children. It's that close. They spread their poison. I haven't heard a whippoorwill since. Wipe them right out. Used to see flocks of cedar waxwing, 60, 70, 80 in a flock. Last 3 years I've seen 14. This year I've seen 3. Half our birds are gone, half our animals are gone, and the rest are sick and dying. And I'm living where I can see what is happening, and it scares me. And it also angers me. And I could go on and on and on on what the white man is doing to this once beautiful country, and not only this country, but all the way around the world, for that thing they worship so much, that dollar bill. But that teacher did say this. She said the American Indians gave corn to the world, and that was it. Is that that's the only thing the Indians ever gave. Well, not only did the American Indian give corn to the world, do you know how many kinds of corn they developed altogether? Altogether, the American Indians developed over 300 different kinds of corn. Over 300 kinds. Even that so-called hybrid corn, the white man boasts to have just discovered the last few years how to have formed, that was known by our Indians in Mexico 1,000 years ago. All of the beans in the entire world came from the American Indian, except for two, horse and soybean. They came from China. Even that famous dish you hear so much about, Boston baked beans, was a Wampanoag Indian dish taught to the pilgrims by the Wampanoag Indians. And that was the first time that white folks enjoyed several dishes we enjoy today. Clam chowder, oyster stew, pumpkin pie, believe it or not, cranberry sauce, corn soup, popcorn, all of our corn, our beans, pumpkin, squash, celery, buckwheat, maple sugar, maple syrup, vanilla, chocolate, peppers, tapioca, Irish potato. That's right, it didn't come from Ireland like everyone thinks. It saved the Irish people, yes, it saved the people of the world, but it was a gift of the American Indian. And that nation of Indians that developed the Irish potato and gave it to the world, you know how many kinds they had? According to the National Geographic magazine, they had over 79 different varieties of Irish potatoes. Sweet potatoes is another gift of the American Indians of the world. And the young people in this country ought to be interested. Even peanuts, popcorn, and chewing gum were gifts of the American Indian. Pineapple didn't come from Hawaii. Pineapple came from our Central American Indians, was brought over to Hawaii. Tapioca didn't come from Africa. It came from our South American Indians, was brought over to Africa. As a matter of fact, according to agricultural scientists, American Indian food plants show a further development from their wild prototypes. That means the plants they originally came from. Then do the food plants of Europe, Africa, or Asia. Take, for instance, peppers and tomatoes, both the gift of the Indians to the world. Now, these two plants belong to a deadly poison family, the nightshade family. The same plant grew in a wild state across the ocean. Yet they never took that plant over there and made it into one good to eat, but our Indians did. And when they offered it to the Spaniards for the first time to eat, you know what the Spaniards thought? They thought they were trying to poison them. Today, the whole world eats peppers and tomatoes. But I bet my shirt that not one person in 10,000 know where they came from, that they came from this land and they were gifts of the American Indian. According to the Museum of Arts and Science in Rochester, and that's one of the best scientific museums in this country, one nation of Indians, the Inca Indians of Peru, originated, developed, and gave to the world more agricultural food plants now in use today than all the European peoples put together. Think of it, all of them put together. French, Scotch, Irish, Russians, German, Polish, Italian, Czechs, all of them combined, didn't give as much as that one Indian nation did. Now, that isn't a wonderful gift to today's civilization. I'd like to know what is. And why they don't put these things in their school books when they're studying about Indians, I'd like to know why not also. It wasn't just agriculture food plants that the Indians gave the world. Look at the medicines that came from the American Indian. What would we have done without quinine in Indian medicine? We might not have built the Panama Canal or won World War I. Quinine is one of many medicines we use today gifts of the American Indian. There's quinine, curare, say the baby. And according to Ripley, believe it or not, the first iodine and aspirin were American Indian medicines. In the 400 years that white men have dominated these two continents, they haven't discovered one, not even one medicine plant that wasn't known by Indians. Even that shirt you got on, it's probably made out of cotton. If it is, it's American Indian cotton. That's right, with a foreign name, Egyptian, attached to it. Don't ask me why. There's 20 or 30 Indian gifts to the world with European or other foreign names attached to them. Very misleading. Like Egyptian cotton, Irish potato, Turkey tobacco, India rubber, Italian beans, Jerusalem artichoke, or Turkey itself, none of which came from across the ocean. It's true the Egyptians did have a cotton, a short-fibered crude cotton I doubt if it's grown commercially anywhere in the world today. No cotton in the entire world had longer or finer fiber than the kind the American Indians developed and gave the world. Do you know what the white man thought it was when they first saw cloth made from it? It was that fine they thought it was silk. Today, it's not only grown here in America, it's grown all over the world, along with the best, the longest stable cotton developed by any people, called South Sea Island cotton, also a gift of the American Indian. Even the government of the United States of America, actually, in many ways, is patterned after the government of the Iroquois Confederacy. The white man across the ocean never had a true democracy. They'll take a magnifying glass and they will desperately, frantically, and vainly look all over the European history to try to find just one democracy, just one, to make good that claim. And they'll come up with this. I got in school, you got in school, my grandchildren will get in school unless they start teaching the truth for a change. They'll say this: the ancient Greeks had a democracy. Doesn't that sound familiar? They'll say the ancient Greeks discovered democracy. Well, I studied that so-called Greek democracy. If that's a democracy, I live on the moon. Over half of them were slaves with no voice at all. Hey, wait a minute. Any country that has slavery, and that includes the United States when they started, is not a pure democracy. And I'll never understand why they connect George Washington and Thomas Jefferson with liberty, freedom, equality, democracy. Are they blind or plain stupid? Washington, they say, had over 400 slaves. Jefferson had the same number of slaves. The Iroquois outlawed slavery in all of their territory. And at one time, their territory was as great as the Roman Empire at its greatest height. Furthermore, in ancient Greece, your mother, your wife, your sister, your daughter wouldn't have a voice, nor would they have a voice anywhere in Europe. Women were considered chattel property, so how in the name of heavens can they call the Greek government or any European government a democracy when one half of them were eliminated because they were women?
That was part of a presentation by Ray Fadden, a teacher and mentor among the Mohawks of Akwesasne. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady.